Conservative? You bet. Controversial? Right again. It's time to squabble on the Jim Benson Show.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Jim Benson Show, conservative talk radio covering the issues that concern you here on the BBS Radio Network. If you'd like to call into the show, the phone number is 888-627-6008. Again, that's 888-627-6008. Well, there's certainly been a lot happening since our last show. Last week's Super Tuesday Democratic primaries provided crushing political defeats for presidential hopefuls Elizabeth Warren, Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, and the left-wing billionaire, another one, Mike Bloomberg, and the surprising reemergence of former Vice President Joe Biden as a Democratic frontrunner, while communist admirer Senator Bernie Sanders saw his rising political star begin to fade, though he's currently second to Biden in delegates. Now, I don't know if all this was really planned or were being played. Who knows? We'll find out soon enough once the Democratic convention is held. But for the moment, Biden is once again the front runner. Here's a brief analysis of Biden's stated positions on some of the issues today, put out by Syracuse.com. Play soundbite one, please.
Wall Street did not build America. You built America. That's fact. You built America.
Former Vice President Joe Biden of Delaware is running for the Democratic Party's presidential nomination. Here's where he stands on six major issues. Biden opposes efforts to repeal the Affordable Care Act. He would build on it by offering a public option like Medicare and a tax credit for health insurance premiums. Biden supported the Senate's 2013 Comprehensive Immigration Reform Bill. He would restore deferred action for childhood arrivals and invest in border technology rather than a wall. Biden proposes a clean energy revolution kickstarted by a $400 billion investment over 10 years in energy research and innovation. He would rejoin the Paris Climate Agreement. Biden's goal is to achieve a 100% clean energy economy and net zero emissions no later than 2050. To bolster middle class competitiveness, Biden would invest $1.3 trillion over 10 years in infrastructure. He would pay for it by reversing Trump's corporate tax cuts, reducing incentives for outsourcing, and ending fossil fuel subsidies. Biden would end the war in Afghanistan and bring home the vast majority of U.S. troops. He would reassess defense spending to equip troops for future challenges in space, cyber warfare, artificial intelligence, and unmanned systems. Biden believes we must look at all low and zero carbon technologies to address the climate crisis. He advocates government research into small, modular nuclear reactors that can be built at half the construction cost of current reactors.
I was one of those taken by surprise at Biden's sudden showing of strength in these latest Democratic primaries, given his lagging behind the other Democratic leftists in the race recently. But yes, it's true that Biden is probably the least left-leaning of the crop of Democrats running against him, though he's obviously willing to merge with them if he deems it expedient. Consider, for example, Biden's declaration after his Super Tuesday wins that he will appoint former Texas congressman and rabid anti-firearms ownership advocate Robert Beto O'Rourke to take charge of gun control measures in a Biden administration. The widespread rallying behind the aging, clearly infirm Joe Biden was chalked up to the Democrat establishment's fears over Sanders' radical leanings and a desire to promote a more centrist presidential candidate. The whole thing is all that much more bizarre to me because the entire Democratic Party, as former Marxist David Horowitz has observed, is the Communist Party, with so many of its members leaning leftward to varying degrees. Yet Sanders too openly typifies that leftward lurch of the party. And that scared many in the party establishment. Being too openly Marxist can get you in trouble with the electorate you're trying to dumb down and control to accomplish your radical goals of transforming America as we have known it. Biden it appears, can be relied upon to come off as a centrist, yet embrace the party's radical ideals to a greater or lesser extent, and thus provides a malleable candidate who can be used, it is hoped, to fool all of the people some of the time and some of the people all of the time. I was apparently wrong in thinking that Mike Bloomberg would be a likely winner in the Democratic presidential races due to his enormous wealth and what I saw as his ability to buy votes. Bloomberg, it was reported, spent $500,000 after a late arrival in the Democratic presidential contest, but fared dismally in two Democratic presidential debates and garnered precious few delegates, with the only jurisdiction he won being American Samoa. Still, it's likely Bloomberg will play an important role in the upcoming Democrat convention this year, given Biden's frailty and Bloomberg being perceived as more centrist and thus more appealing to a greater number of the electorate. We really don't know what's going on and exactly what's going to happen. All kinds of scenarios could play out. Bloomberg could wind up still being vice president, getting a nomination. If Biden decides to bow out, Hillary Clinton could play a role. There could be other people. We just don't know yet. It's all rather strange, but it's continuing to unfold, and we'll be following it. Whether or not that happens, Bloomberg getting a role as vice president or something, or Bloomberg, who has endorsed Biden, is a force to be reckoned with politically and could spend potentially billions more of his own money to get Biden and other Democrats elected. I read that Bloomberg and his organization spent well over $100 million to help Democrats in the 2018 midterm elections that saw the party take control of the U.S. House of Representatives. And Bloomberg himself has bragged that he basically brought that about, or at least contributed significantly to it. On the last show, I mentioned Bloomberg's extensive and deepening financial interests in communist China, whose leaders he has praised and whose business he courts. I noted a news report that the former New York City mayor has been forging close financial ties with communist China, including expanding one of his financial information company's indexes, which could steer some $150 billion into China while earning him an undisclosed amount in fees. It's easy to see why Bloomberg would not like President Trump's efforts to scale back America's growing dependence on cheap labor and products from mainland China. Here's some audio from Fox's Tucker Carlson tonight, March 7th, proclaiming that extortion from China is a real threat today. Play soundbite 2, please.
Good evening and welcome to Tucker Carlson Tonight. There comes a time in every presidential administration when the people in charge realize they're not really in control. Unforeseen events arise. In an instant, every assumption about the future changes. Heads of state die, wars erupt, natural disasters descend, epidemics rage. None of it was in anybody's plan. There's something about human nature that prevents us from preparing for this, for abrupt and radical change. We pretend the unexpected will never happen. But there's something in nature itself that reminds us it inevitably will. It's always a terrifying realization. The rise of the Chinese coronavirus is that kind of moment. The virus is quickly becoming a global pandemic. Ultimately, it could kill millions. At the very least, it will reorder the global economy and change our politics. Could the disease help determine the outcome of our next presidential election 8 months from now? Of course it could. In fact, it will. Our leaders can't stop that. Like all matters of life and death, it is beyond human power to affect. But they can respond to the threat in a way that makes this country stronger, not weaker. How can they do that? Here's how. The first step is to take the virus seriously and to convince the public that you are. In 1918, Woodrow Wilson's White House downplayed the Spanish influenza and refused to take obvious precautions to slow its spread. Wilson had a pointless war in progress in Europe to fight. His generals couldn't be distracted from that goal. So the government continued to ship men to overcrowded army camps across the country and to pack them on ships to France. The virus spread exponentially. In the end, about 53,000 American soldiers were killed in combat in that war. At least 675,000 Americans died of the flu. Could Wilson have prevented that disaster? Well, not entirely. But by early and decisive action, he could have improved America's odds. So what does effective action look like now? Well, we ought to be screening people when they get off the planes from infected countries. That's not complicated. It's obvious. But at the same time, it is hardly a solution. We should be honest about how much we can do to keep the Chinese coronavirus from coming here. 100 years ago, the Spanish flu killed a significant percentage of the population in remote Aleutian Islands. And that was before air travel. Today, the entire world is connected by hourly international flights. Global pandemics are inevitable. There's too much movement to keep viruses isolated. We should acknowledge that. Yes, we can do our best to keep foreign diseases out of this country, but we ought to spend most of our time trying to figure out how to protect Americans once the diseases get here. There's still a lot we don't know about the Chinese coronavirus, but two things do seem clear. It is highly communicable, and the elderly and people with pre-existing respiratory disease face the greatest threat from it. That means for most Americans, the biggest risks will come not from the virus itself, but from its ancillary effects. People will panic, travel will be disrupted, markets will tumble, and, most critically, hospitals will be overwhelmed. We're about to learn the limits of our healthcare system. Conditions will be tough for the many thousands of Americans looking for beds to recover from the flu. In Seattle, they already are. But things will be even worse for anyone suffering from, say, pancreatitis or a burst appendix, not to mention countless other health emergencies. People like this may not get care at all. Our system won't be able to accommodate them. There are many implications of this, and some of them are political. For example, is this really the time to invite the rest of the world to join Medicare for All? Probably not. That idea was always stupid. Now it's clearly dangerous. On a practical level, saving American medicine from collapse must be our leader's top priority right now. We need to expand emergency hospital bed capacity. We need to make certain we have enough life-saving drugs and medical equipment, the basics. Unfortunately, that's not as simple as it sounds or as it should be. Well, the rest of us who are arguing about sexism and transgendered bathrooms, China took control of our healthcare system. China dominates the world market in pharmaceutical ingredients, compounds used in virtually every essential medicine for high blood pressure, for cancer, for Alzheimer's disease, and many more come from China. So the key components in vital medical technology, CT scanners, X-ray machines, ultrasounds. As of tonight, more than 95% of all the antibiotics in America are manufactured in communist China. 95%. Our chief global rival has a total monopoly on the most important medicine in the world.
I'll have more to say about the emerging coronavirus epidemic in a few minutes, but Carlson is right about the bigger long-term threat of America becoming vulnerable to extortion from China. I'm reminded of Lenin's famous comment about capitalists, of which there are different interpretations, but the one I like the best is him being quoted as saying, "When it comes time to hang the capitalists, they'll be eager to sell us the rope." Many of the American corporations have rushed to do business with China, which has gotten all kinds of favors politically, economically, and has grown rich and powerful as a result, and also dominating increasingly America in different ways, such as with pharmaceutical production. Yet the globalists, the elite of Davos and so forth, these people want to continue this because they're getting filthy rich. And it's interesting that they also want us to become the subjects of their social justice schemes. It's true that so many of these people want capitalism for themselves, but promote progressive policies for the masses. Perhaps that makes them feel better about their guilt over being rich. I don't know. Indeed, while most Americans continue to go blandly about their business of their daily lives, largely if not entirely oblivious to the growing power and influence of communist China, many have lost their jobs and livelihoods as the companies that employed them moved their manufacturing operations to mainland China. Other American corporations that would have employed Americans established their operations from the beginning in that country. While it's true that many American companies have been profiting handsomely by doing these things, I began to realize more and more that this is not just some haphazard effect of a general desire in the West to befriend and positively influence a totalitarian superpower. If you've been listening to our shows, we've been presenting more and more evidence that all this is part of a grand scheme intended to fundamentally change America and the rest of the world. Along these lines, let's listen to an automated reciting of a recent article on Breitbart News, that's Breitbart.com, by Breitbart's James Pinkerton, discussing the new book, The New Class War, Saving Democracy from the Managerial Elite, by Texas educator Michael Lind. This is a robot reading of Pinkerton's article, which is perhaps not the best recitation of the text, but still provides a pretty good audio version of it. Please play soundbite 3.
Pinkerton, The New Class War Exposes the Oligarchs and Their Enablers, by James P. Pinkerton on February 16, 2020. The Threat from the Managerial Overclass. It's fitting that a new book with a provocative title, The New Class War, Saving Democracy from the Managerial Elite, came out the same week that the global elite had convened at the World Economic Forum at Davos, Switzerland. If by chance, dear reader, you didn't make it to Davos, Michael Lind's book will help explain the strategies and tactics of the globetrotters and globalizers. And of course, every day since Davos, we can see for ourselves the actions of the Davos men. For instance, there's Michael Bloomberg, who is spending hundreds of millions, and who knows, maybe soon billions, of dollars in pursuit of the presidency. And there's another billionaire, Tom Steyer, whose fortune, while immense, is still miniature next to that of Mayor Mike. Sorry, Tom, you've been outbid. And then there's Mayor Pete Buttigieg, McKinsey & Co.'s man in the Midwest. Buttigieg is not rich himself, at least not yet, but he is the preferred candidate of many rich people. In the meantime, Lind's book is not a play-by-play. Instead, it's a deep analysis of the powerful forces shaping and twisting our lives. So if the news consumer wishes to get a better understanding of how the plutocracy, including plutocratic minions such as Buttigieg, are operating, The New Class War makes for an excellent guidebook. Lind, a professor at the University of Texas, argues that the theory and practice of plutocracy these days isn't just about the rich guarding their money, although they certainly do a good job of that, but it's also about the rich trumpeting their values, as well as trickling them down to the rest of us. The rich do a good job of that, too. As Lind writes, the new class war is very real, and the managerial class is winning. In using the phrase managerial class, Lind intends for his dissection of plutocracy to include more than just the actions of the planet's billionaires. That is, the politicking of the 2,153 individuals and families worldwide who wield more wealth than 4.6 billion people on Earth. Lind also analyzes the helpers and facilitators of these billionaires and their wingmen, the mere millionaires. Lind wants to show us the actions of the politicians, corporate executives, bureaucrats, journalists, propagandists, public interest lawyers, and professors who run interference for the rich. It's this managerial class, sometimes also known as the new class, hence the sly pun in the title of Lind's book, The New Class War, that gives our age its distinctive cultural signature. Yes, the rich are rich and want to stay that way, and yet at the same time, fat cats now lean left, even far left, on cultural issues and they want you to do as you're told. This phenomenon of woke capitalism has been chronicled for years here at Breitbart News, but Lind weaves it into a larger discussion of national and international power. As he writes of this managerial class, it represents a fusion of the three elites at the commanding heights of the economy, the culture and politics. He further adds that this trio increasingly constitutes a single conformist caste. Because this managerial caste or class, or overclass, has been mostly united on key issues, it has proven itself to be extraordinarily effective. These hired managerialists have reliably protected the richness of the rich. And yet, at the same time, they have propagated the new progressive values of the upper class. Thus the old stereotype of the tycoon or corporate chieftain as some sort of conservative stuffed shirt has been replaced by such hipper-than-thou figures as Richard Branson, Elon Musk, and the various Silicon Valley masters of the universe. And, of course, along the way, the hipster CEO is absolved of any responsibility to help uphold good cultural order. The rich and powerful have been unleashed to be rich and powerful without bearing responsibility for anything other than making money for themselves and being cool. It's this decoupling of power from responsibility that has had such a dramatic effect on corporate behavior and on social morale. Indeed, as we see with ex-football player Colin Kaepernick, now a corporate dream teamer, the managerial class has actually reached down and captured much of the popular culture. The biggest corporations now are frequently on the side of any progressive cause that comes along. Lind decries, for instance, corporate-sponsored asymmetric multiculturalism, in which person of color folk traditions are hailed as authentic, while white folk traditions are either ignored or outright disdained as racist. In fact, capitalism has proven itself adroit at, well, capitalizing on every trend and meme, no matter how destructive. Thus a capitalist is now selling an anarcho-communist hoodie to the radically chic, for $770. And yet as Lind argues, being progressive doesn't mean being in favor of progressive incomes taxes or any sort of progressive wealth distribution. It means being rich, and staying rich, while preaching in favor of mostly symbolic social change. That is, the rich seek to replace an understanding of economic class with a new consciousness about gender and race. And yes, that works out well for the rich, since the middle class becomes the new target, accused of sexism and racism. In the meantime, as Lind further argues, such symbolic cultural posturing provides cover for the economic interests of corporations and their owners as they engage in plunder tactics straight out of the 19th century. For instance, the whole category of gig economy companies, such as Uber, now argue that their employees aren't employees at all, but, rather, independent contractors. And thus a century of legal protections for workers, starting with the 40-hour week, as well as rules about overtime pay, all goes out the window. Moreover, if American workers don't like the offer they get from their bosses, the bosses know they can simply take their factory, or even their office, overseas. Or perhaps the owners can simply bring in illegal aliens to do the same work in the U.S. for far less. The socioeconomic results of these tactics have been entirely predictable. In this woke globalized economy, corporate profits have soared, thanks to what Lind calls the international arbitrage of companies being able to play off workforces and tax collectors against each other around the world, finagling their way to lower costs, higher profits, and near-zero tax rates. At the same time, wages have flattened. According to one estimate, in the U.S., after-tax incomes for the bottom 98% of Americans have risen about 75% in the last half-century, while incomes of the top 1% have risen about 350%, or almost five times more. And incomes for the top 0.1% have risen more than 500%. And incomes for the top 0.01% have risen even higher, by 650%. In fact, according to several studies, the rich haven't been this rich since the 1920s. Lind adds that in addition to their resurgent economic power, the rich have never been more culturally powerful. So powerful, in fact, that they can rearrange the social and cultural lives of the masses. From its citadels in a few big cities, this oligarchy periodically notifies the working class majority with values and opinions about sex, immigration and other topics it must immediately adopt without debate, on pain of being blacklisted by the private sector, prosecuted by the government or censored or erased by the media. The perfect expression of this economic and cultural onslaught is, of course, Mike Bloomberg. Having piled up $61 billion, give or take, on Wall Street, Bloomberg, for a time, was content to worry about banning soda pop, controlling guns, and shutting down coal mines and the jobs that go with them. And yet now, on top of all that, he wants to buy Let's Not Kid Ourselves by using any other verb the White House. Interestingly, in addition to his leftward missions of social engineering, Bloomberg has taken on a rightward mission of economic self-interest for himself and his fat cat friends, stopping a wealth tax. So we can see, the Manhattanite wants to have his cake and eat it, too. He seeks to spend his mountain of money as he pleases and not split more of it with the IRS. For the man who has everything, that's everything. In Lind's reckoning, Bloomberg epitomizes overclass managerial ideology. It leans to the right on economics, at least as far as the rich are concerned. Low effective tax rates, free trade, no meaningful limits on campaign spending, and leans to the left on cultural issues. This mix, Lind says, is libertarian, that word being a hybrid of libertarian and liberal. Of course, not everyone supports this liberal-libertarian-libertarianism. To name just one opponent, there's Donald Trump. Defying the liberal academic herd, Lind describes Trump's victory, as well as Brexit and other populist nationalist wins, as the result of the populist backlash against the dominion of the libertarians. Thus the battle is joined, in Lind's telling, the hysteria over the last 4 years about Russian interference is mostly a fable that the establishment tells itself, and tells us. The libertarian elite would rather say that popular eruptions are the doing of the Russians, not the residue of their own unpopular policies. And as these battle lines are drawn, we see down deep that the elites and the masses are, as Lynn says, on opposite sides. Once again, the really rich tilt right on economics. Again, as economics applies to them and their portfolios, they care little about what happens to Joe or Josie Sixpack. And tilt left on culture, average folks tilt left on economics and right on culture. And that means that whatever happens to Trump in the coming year, the larger fight will continue on for a long time. For instance, there's the issue of Social Security, which is the principal source of retirement income for most Americans, although, of course, not for the rich. So it's no surprise, as Lindt writes, that Main Street supports keeping that earned entitlement just the way it is. A Pew poll in March 2019 found that 74% of American adults and 68% of Republicans and Republican-leaning voters oppose any cuts to Social Security. Those are thumping numbers in favor of preserving Social Security, which has, after all, been the centerpiece of the social welfare state over the last 8 decades. Yet as we have leaned by now, the rich see the world differently. From the perspective of some mountaintop at Davos, or from a high-rise in Manhattan, or an estate in Beverly Hills, Social Security is just another program for the unglamorous, politically incorrect middle class. And so there's always some think tank study that says that the proles wouldn't mind if the program were trimmed or even transformed, especially if Wall Street could benefit. Here's Lynd, reflecting donor over class priorities. President George W. Bush made cutting Social Security by means of partial privatization the centerpiece of his second-term agenda. Okay, that was Bush, faithful to some libertarian economic playbook. But then, proving that this fused libertarian mindset is bipartisan, Lynd adds, President Barack Obama, meanwhile, was the first Democratic president to propose cutting Social Security by means of inflation adjustments. We can further add that Obama's vice president, Joe Biden, has said many times that he wants to see Social Security cut. Biden preached cuts mostly inside the Beltway, when he figured his audience was like-minded elitists. Yet now that he faces outside the Beltway scrutiny on the campaign trail, he is furiously denying what he has so visibly said on camera. We'll soon know if the voters let him get away with such fibbing. For his part, President Trump is often on Lynd's wavelength, that is, thinking like the guy or gal on Main Street, not like Davos man or Davos woman. And around the world, other political leaders have noticed Trump's maverick ideology, in the admiring words of former Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott. Speaking on January 21, Trump is the first major global leader who has figured out that lower and middle income workers are becoming more conservative while well-to-do have become more liberal. Abbott described Trump's thinking as social fabric conservatism. That's a good phrase. It sounds a bit, in fact, like another good phrase. Marco Rubio's Common Good Capitalism.
To clarify something here, he points out that the rich tilt right on economics, that is for themselves. He did say that, but a number of times he leaves it alone. The author here, Pinkerton, they oppose tax increases on themselves, but not for you. The masses get to be used in their social justice, the elite's social justice schemes, and in so doing so are impoverished and enslaved. So no problem. Cut your Social Security, cut your wages to make them richer and feel better about themselves. He mentioned the elite's desire or support for cutting Social Security. I think I've heard Bloomberg say it's just a runaway entitlement out of control. There's a bill. There was a bill in Congress and by a Democratic representative, U.S. representative, I believe, which would fund Social Security for the next 40 years. It does include an increase in taxes. That's going to have to be done. Anyway, one way or the other, if you're going to keep the entitlement as it is, this bill would actually increase the payouts and fund the thing for 40 years according to the actuarial studies. It would involve a proposed tax increase of 1.2% on both you and your employer. It would be phased in over a number of years. So you'd go from 6.2%, I believe, of your salary being paid into Social Security to 7.4% over a number of years. You wouldn't even notice it. It seems like the right thing to do. I understood it had broad bipartisan support, but I have not heard much more about it. But these are things that Social Security, some people call it a socialist entitlement, but it actually pays for itself. I think it was a very good idea. And I'm among many people who want to have that for my retirement. So you see, there is a plutocracy, a group of fabulously wealthy elites who favor ultra-capitalism for themselves while promoting progressive collectivist policies for the masses to control, if not outright enslave us. We'll be doing lots more on this in the future shows. The thing to keep in mind here is that many in our country's political, economic, and social institutions are the cheerleaders and servants of these plutocrats, if not actually being part of them. Thus, some in the Republican Party, but most in the Democratic Party apparatuses, along with much of our educational establishment, the mainstream media, our governmental bureaucracies, and social media, are the members or servants and puppets of this plutocracy. That being said, those of us who cherish our freedoms and believe in our traditions face a truly daunting political task in trying to get our message out to the people and help them to resist becoming the hapless dupes of the elites and suffering ultimate ruination of life in America as we have known it. This, of course, is not to say that everything has been perfect in our country. Never was, never will be. But things as a whole are a lot better than they could be and likely would be should we succumb to the globalist threat many people do not even realize we are facing. The 2020 elections will be an important political battleground where this power struggle will play out. One big problem we are facing is voter fraud, which, while not exclusively benefiting the political left and their globalist handlers, does primarily benefit them and enable them. Here's audio from a YouTube video from PragerU with Eric Eggers titled, "Is Voter Fraud Real?" Play soundbite 4, please.
While the major media fixates on the influence of foreign powers on American elections, a much more serious attack has been taking place right under our noses. Good old-fashioned, homegrown voter fraud. Let's look at three of the worst offenses. Example number one, bloated voter rolls. In 244 counties across the United States, there are more registered voters than there are people legally eligible to vote. 29 states have counties with more registered voters than legal residents, and 8 states have more registered voters than actual voting age people. When the Supreme Court upheld Ohio's efforts to clean up its own voter rolls in 2018, the majority opinion cited Pew Center statistics. 24 million voter registrations in the United States are either invalid or significantly inaccurate. And nearly 3 million people are believed to be registered to vote in more than one state. These numbers have a shocking implication. It's very easy to exploit our voting system. During an undercover investigation, New York City detectives made 63 attempts to cast illegal ballots based on flawed voter rolls. They were successful 61 times. Similar investigations in other cities and other states produced the same dismal results. But phony voters on the rolls is just one threat to election integrity. Here's example number two, ballot harvesting. In 2016, the state of California, one of the states with more registered voters than citizens, became the first state to legalize the practice of ballot solicitation, that is, the collection and delivery of ballots by third parties. With no trace of irony, this is called ballot harvesting. It works like this. In California, organizations with a clear political agenda are legally permitted to go to a location, say a nursing home or a church, and collect, literally harvest, ballots. The third party then transports these ballots to a polling place or an election office. This raises an obvious question. Once this third party collects the ballots, what's to stop them from changing them or from just throwing out the ones they don't like? A guilty conscience? How do we know ballot harvesters from Democratic organizations aren't destroying Republican ballots? Or Republican harvesters aren't destroying Democratic ballots? We don't. We have no way of knowing. Let's look at one specific example. On election night in 2018, California Central Valley Republican Congressman David Valadao held a 5,000-vote lead over his challenger, Democrat T.J. Cox. The margin was wide enough that the networks even called the race for Valadao, the Republican incumbent. But wait. There were late ballots still to be delivered by the third-party vote harvesters. When those votes came in, they broke so overwhelmingly for Cox, in a historically conservative district, no less, that Valadao's 5,000-vote victory became an 862-vote loss. Maybe that was just a coincidence. Or maybe not. In the first major election after ballot harvesting was allowed in California, Democrats won every single congressional seat in Orange County, which had been a Republican stronghold for decades. A year earlier, no sober person would have thought that possible. Voter corruption example number 3, voting by non-citizens. Should you have to be a citizen to vote? Silly question, right? It was once, not anymore. According to a recent poll, more than half of Democrats, 53%, support granting illegal immigrants the right to vote. Forget the legal ones. Democratic National Chair Tom Perez, before working for the Obama administration, worked for a group called Casa de Maryland, which has been a longtime advocate for expanding non-citizen voting rights. Yes, it's true that federal law prohibits non-citizens from voting in federal elections, but 11 states, all run by Democrats, currently allow non-citizen voting of some kind. Cities such as Chicago and San Francisco, for example, allow non-citizens to vote in certain citywide elections. Why? Because for progressives, demography is destiny, and many see illegal immigrants as future voters. So there you have it, 3 different ways to tamper with the vote. Bloated voter rolls, ballot harvesting, voting by non-citizens. These are just 3 ways in which the left creates a clear advantage for itself on election day. The major media will tell you that corrupt voting practices either don't exist or are so minor they don't matter. But to believe that, you have to believe 2 things. That voter registration rolls are accurate and secure from fraudulent registrations. And that no one is trying to manipulate the results for political purposes. Those are 2 very big leaps. Maybe you want to make those leaps because you like the results they produce. But if you care about free and fair elections, no matter which party you belong to, you need to pay attention. Or pretty soon, free and fair elections will be a quaint relic of the past. No foreign government can undermine our democracy, but Americans can. And some do. I'm Eric Eggers, investigative reporter for the Government Accountability Institute for Prager University.
As he was talking, he mentioned formerly conservative Orange County in the greater Los Angeles area of California. One of the people elected was left-wing Democratic Congressman Harley Ruda. For the first time Democrat – a first-time Democrat in a long-time Republican district. Ruda, I understand, was given $3 million by Mike Bloomberg. So you begin to see how these things are intertwined, the left's desire to gain control. We've also talked about the illegal voting by non-citizens. Of the conservative watchdog group Judicial Watch has projected that estimated that some 1.2 million non-citizens voted illegally in the 2016 elections and another 900,000 in the 2018 midterms. So these are very real and serious problems that we're facing. So much more needs to be done between now and Election Day 2020, including careful monitoring of our election and electoral processes and concerted firm challenges of voting irregularities. Along with this, there should be a major effort to wake up the electorate with things like widespread print and electronic media presentations, such as documentaries exposing the left's corruption and agendas, voter registration drives, including old-fashioned knocking on doors and related activities, to get out the vote for our causes. There isn't a lot of time left for all this. Okay, now on to more on the coronavirus. As you may be aware, much of the mainstream media and alternative media are filled with reports of dire news and opinion on the state of the threat from the coronavirus outbreaks around the world. These include predictions of the worst possible outcomes, such as millions of dead and economic and political chaos. I know that conspiracy theorist Alex Jones on his radio program, even yesterday, was citing figures, estimates that perhaps 500,000 Americans will be dead by the 4th of July. And there will be much chaos in the country as a result. He's calling it World War IV, I guess World War III being the Cold War. And he, of course, is pushing the theory that this was coronavirus was created in a laboratory here in Canada and given to the Chinese, the Chi Coms, who want to get rid of Trump and so on and so forth. These things go on forever. A lot of this stuff is conjecture. There may be evidence or there may be some truth to it, but we just don't know. We are not seeing this here yet. It is a growing threat. It is a pandemic. We are seeing serious problems around the world with this outbreak. It is very highly contagious. We don't know exactly where it came from. Scientists are learning more about it every day. There are different statistics cited showing that a higher death rate with the coronavirus than originally thought or in some other projections, 3-4%, sometimes 5%. Others say, no, it's really below 1%, but you need to account for all the people affected and so on and so on. This is going to play out and fairly quickly, but at this time we are not facing a massive death threat from this in this country. Now, we will see very quickly where we go with that, but at present we are not seeing such devastation here in the U.S. as being projected by some of these people and in the media. Although stock markets have been reacting badly to all the fears and new data on the increasing number of coronavirus cases and deaths, and this is sure to have some kind of economic impact. We still don't know a great deal about the disease, except that it is highly contagious and can be deadly, especially for those with weakened immune systems and those suffering already from other diseases and medical conditions. A lot of this has to do with respiratory illness. The latest official medical data and reporting show that the overwhelming majority of people afflicted with the coronavirus recover from it. I'm confident that our country's healthcare institutions are working diligently to respond appropriately to the crisis and are doing everything possible within our means to provide the best care for those afflicted and to protect those who are not. If it gets out of control, that situation could change, and these people could be overwhelmed. And this is the great fear. We will know very soon if these efforts will be sufficient. That being said, there's no question that we are facing a serious national and global health threat, and it behooves all of us to do what we can individually to protect ourselves from it. This includes not being willing to rely solely on the medical establishment for protection. We should all be doing whatever we can to stay as healthy as possible, avoid exposure, and be ready to help ourselves in whatever ways we can should we become infected. This would include doing the typical things they recommend, health authorities recommend to protect yourself from the flu and cold, such as washing your hands, avoiding people who are sick, staying home when you're sick. We could also be stocking up on natural substances that can help prevent the spread of the virus and lessen its severity. Toward that end, let's listen to some video on band.video from the Alex Jones radio show of Infowars.com. This particular soundbite features Mike Adams of an interesting website he has called naturalnews.com. We played audio previously featuring Adams engaging in speculation about the extent of the coronavirus threat. Adams, who's been closely following events and reports about this pandemic, features dire warnings on his website, including the following that was there yesterday when I looked at the site. Right at the top of the first page of the site, it shows official – it states official, in parentheses, rigged, close parentheses, coronavirus count, colon. 103,627 infected, comma, 3,520 dead. Below that, he's got another headline, realistic estimates, colon, 500 plus thousand infected, comma, 35,000 plus dead. Well, again, these are estimates. He cites several thousand people in Korea, South Korea, Italy, Iran, France, Germany being the lowest with 684. Then there's another headline below that stating, quote, shocking new study concludes that, quote, the best scenario, unquote, for a COVID-19, that's another term for coronavirus, pandemic is 15 million dead. But again, these are wild extrapolations and estimations we don't know yet. Around the world, yes, it's possible. I'm not trying to underplay this, but I'm just stating that at this point, we're not seeing this kind of thing happening here or anywhere else in the world. Another thing to point out, too, is if you've been watching YouTube videos, certainly YouTube's had quite a bit on the coronavirus, and they also have been talking about the so-called Spanish flu of World War I era, around 1918, which killed an estimated 50 to 100 million people worldwide. You see that the – this is also pointed out, I think, on the Tucker Carlson audio earlier – pictures of – you see pictures from that era with troop ships packed stem to stern with thousands of GIs. These people were brought over on these boats and brought back on the boats packed like sardines. And in the trenches as well, they were very closely together. And the flu spread like wildfire and mutated. And so while 53,000 Americans were killed in combat in World War I, 675,000 Americans died from the flu epidemic. Supposedly, the flu came back in 1918 after being a milder version in the previous year, and it had mutated to become a very deadly form, which sometimes included what they called hemorrhagic fever, where people get these raging fevers and bleed from their mouth and their ears and so forth, their eyes. Sometimes they would turn blue and die a few hours after coming down with a fever. But we have learned a lot since then. And whatever you want to say about communist China, they have been doing a great deal to isolate people. Happening in other parts of the world as well. So I'm of the opinion that at this point, we may be able to prevent a deadly, deadly worldwide pandemic. However, we'll have to see how this plays out. And we will know fairly soon. In this presentation that I'm about to play, Mike Adams talks about the natural substance he claims defeat the coronavirus. I thought it was worth hearing what Adams has to say. Play soundbite 5, please.
While the brainwashed masses are waiting around 18 months for the pharmaceutical industry to come up with a vaccine that probably won't work, but it will be laced with toxic ingredients, you could be doing things right now to enhance your health by changing your diet. And that's the subject of this segment. Thank you for joining me. Mike Adams here from Natural News on the Alex Jones Show with solutions for coronavirus. Now, I've been doing a lot of research the last few days on certain molecules, because I study molecules all the time in the lab. I run multiple mass spec instruments. We do time of flight mass spec, triple quad mass spec. We do pesticide analysis, CBD analysis for quantitation of cannabinoids and things like that. So I'm very familiar with this area of research. And I was looking at what are the most likely natural molecules that can inhibit the enzymatic processes required for the coronavirus to replicate. One target for that is called 3CL or 3C-like protease. Which is an enzyme that's necessary when the virus takes over your body's cells. It needs that enzyme function in order to continue to replicate and you know, swarm your body with more viruses. Now, the good news is that there's a ton of research on this because of SARS. So back in 2003, when SARS first had its outbreak, and remember, SARS is a coronavirus, and it shares about 80% of the genetic code, which means the protein structure, with the current Wuhan coronavirus, nCoV coronavirus, or whatever new name they have now. They keep changing the name every day to try to distance it from China, by the way. So they keep coming up with new names. But if you go back and look at the research on SARS, it's quite fascinating. After the SARS outbreak at that time, China itself funded a tremendous amount of research into natural herbs and foods, substances, various molecules, various bioflavonoids, for example, typically from fruits, Chinese medicine substances, also prescription drugs as well. They tested every chemical they could think of against SARS, and they found quite a few molecules that would have a very strong inhibitory effect against the 3CL protease process in the body. And right now I'm documenting those. I'm going to share a few with you here today, but I'm doing more research and more documentation so that I can present this publicly with good research behind it. Lots of papers that out there on this right now. So the good news is you don't have to be killed by this, and there is good, steady research right now about what can work. And so let me give you an example. One of the interesting things here is I found a theoretical research paper that was doing protein modeling. This is a theoretical paper, not a clinical trial, but it found that one of the food chemicals that can function theoretically to help stop this virus is called herbacetin. Herbacetin, H-E-R-B-A-C-E-T-I-N. Turns out it's a phytochemical found in flaxseed. So you can eat flaxseed right now, and you can get herbacetin in your body at some level. Now, I haven't tested flaxseed for what concentration of herbacetin is found in flaxseed. It might be that you have to eat pounds of flaxseed to get a therapeutic dose of this. I don't know the answer to that yet. But the truth is, it can't hurt to eat flaxseed. That's the thing. There's no risk, there's no downside to eating healthier, and you're going to get some nutrients that may actually work to block this virus. So that's one of them, herbacetin, in flaxseed. And by the way, flaxseed is rich with omega-3s, and it protects your heart. It helps prevent type 2 diabetes. I mean, it stabilizes blood sugar. Flaxseed is amazing. I put some in my smoothie every day, and I've been doing it for years. I'm drinking ground up flaxseed every day. And not just flax oil, by the way, flax lignans, flax fiber is very good for you. So, you know, part of this is eat more flax, okay? Now, then some critic would say, well, you're telling people to eat flaxseed and not take the vaccine. You moron, there is no vaccine. But you can get flaxseed at the grocery store right now, so do what you can now. It doesn't mean that you can't consider other options later on. You can consider prescription drugs. You can consider a vaccine if you want to take that risk. You can consider all those things. But you can eat flax too. It's called complementary medicine. You can have food and nutrients that work for this. And by the way, speaking of food, there's another bioflavonoid that we found in the research that is found in orange peels. And I actually did an article on this. It's mentioned in a patent of an antiviral sanitizing spray that you can spray on the surface, and it kills coronavirus. So this is known to kill viruses on surfaces, and it's a patented formulation based on bioflavonoids, mostly from citrus peels. So when I found that, you know what I did? I went out and I ordered certified organic orange peel granules. And as soon as I get those, I'm going to be mixing those into my smoothies, because you know how you can have orange zest as a spice? You know, a lot of meals, you know, I don't know, high-end chefs or something, high-end restaurants, they'll have some orange zest on your food. Well, turns out that orange peel, although not typically considered a food, you wouldn't want to make a meal out of it, but you could buy candied orange peels, for example. You can use orange zest as a spice, and it's full of nutrients. And some of these nutrients have an antiviral effect. Isn't that amazing? So, and that's just another example. Again, I have a lot more research on this. Here's something else. We found that there is a tree, I'm not going to name it yet, but there's a tree that grows in Korea, Taiwan, and Japan. The bark of this tree naturally synthesizes a molecule that kills coronavirus. And this wood has a very special smell. I've actually got samples of it right next door here. It has a very special smell. It's used in exotic wood carving and wood furniture. When I visited temples in Taiwan when I lived there, I remember the smell because that was the furniture. It was carved out of this very, very special exotic wood. And it's used in Korea and Japan, Taiwan, and even China. This wood contains a chemical that kills coronavirus. So isn't it interesting that the people in the countries that are being hit by this virus, they are living among trees that are already growing the cure? For free, naturally. And yet they're waiting for a vaccine. And many of them will die waiting for a vaccine or waiting for a drug because they don't recognize the medicine that's already there all around them, indigenous to the area. Mother Nature's already put the cures there. We just have to be wise enough to recognize them.
Adams goes on to cite other things like exotic spices and cuisine from the Far East that are believed to help protect you from the coronavirus. You can see more of what he has to say on band.video or also on his website. I was very sick last year with the flu for on and off about 5 weeks and its after effects, the flu and its after effects. I work in an office with 170 people, and the epidemics that sweep through there every year are terrible. And there was a high-end vitamin company called Life Extension. They had a color glossy magazine they put out. They have one, and they had an article about the flu last year, came out about this time. And they talk about elderberry extract. Even WebMD, which is part of the medical staff, it says elderberry has the same effect as Tamiflu in that it helps suppress the replication of the flu virus. I started taking elderberry every day as a precaution months ago, and I have not been sick with the flu yet. Of course, the flu season isn't over. And I've also been taking French oakwood extract, the article recommends. That's you can buy that on the internet as well. Something they have – they also mentioned cimetidine, which is a heartburn drug. The bottom line here is it's well worth it to review the medical research about the coronavirus and do everything you can to get educated about it and take all the precautions you can. Well, that's it for another show. As always, I hope you found the material presented of value. Look for us again 2 weeks from now in this same time slot. Have a good rest of your weekend.